The following presentation is brought to you by Priority One.
We discussed over a few weeks some of the general principles involved in the basics of parenting. And I think at this point it would be worthwhile to go into some specific areas which could serve as chizuk for us in terms of dealing with our children, dealing with preventing problems, and dealing with them maybe as they come up. One of the, a dual emotion that it's critical at all times to be strengthening is a sense of the relevance and benefits of Torah and the truth of Torah. The way that Torah makes me happy, makes me feel good about myself, as we've defined it, and the truth of Torah Misinai. The subtleties in both of these are much more effective than the onslaught of attack to prove or to indicate or to convince something. In general, subtle presentation, agav urcha, you know, kila chayad, a funny thing happened to me on the way to the office kind of presentations, always seem to work better. And the parsha is often a stepping stone to such presentations. This parsha is really a major piece of the encounter between Yaakov and Esav. Yaakov is coming back to Eretz Yisrael, and Esav is there to greet him, and initially his intent certainly was not to greet him as a long-lost beloved brother, but to interfere with his return, with his 400 soldiers armed for battle. And there's an interesting comment. It's found in an obscure, not well-known Sefer Sipurei Neflois, Miteras Hashem Yisborach. I believe it has a Haskoma from Yerushua Leib Diskin. And he speaks there about a general pattern of Jewish history. The pattern of Jewish history being that Klal Yisroel is engaged from its earliest stages in a battle between good and evil. Good represented by Yaakov, Yisroel, Klal Yisroel, and evil represented by the forces of Esav eventually becoming a Molech, and a descendant of Esav, a grandson, and throughout the generations. And what we find is that this battle is ongoing throughout history. Eventually, we are told that we'll reach the stage that eventually the Yeshua will come to Yerushalayim, to Har Tzion, and Har Esav will be taken to justice, taken to task, and Hashem's Malchus, the kingdom of Hashem, will be recognized by the entire world. And the battle between good and evil, between Yaakov and Esav, between Klal Yisroel and Amalek, is the ultimate battle that is the fight for the overpowering of the forces of evil, and the fight on the part of the forces of evil to overpower the forces of good, being Klal Yisroel. And only when we have the final victory in that battle will it be V'hoysol Hashem Hamalucha. And it could be interesting to trace with our children, they have to be a little bit older for this, the history of this battle. Actually, the battle started od bebeten imo, when they were in their mother's womb. Yaakov and Esav seemed to be struggling. Who should come out first into Eretz Yisroel? Because the concept being that Klal Yisroel in Eretz Yisroel has the power of bringing Geula le'olam. And of course we know that Esav attempted and eventually succeeded in keeping Yaakov from coming out first. This encounter happens again when Yaakov is attempting to return to Eretz Yisroel, to come back to Eretz Yisroel, and Esav is opposing him with his soldiers to prevent that return. We find once again in our history that at the time when Klal Yisrael leaves Mitzrayim and is on its way to Eretz Yisrael, that who, the first of the nations to attack us, was Amalek, the descendants of Esau, trying to prevent our entry into Eretz Yisrael and bringing about the benefit, the success of good over evil, the Hoysal Hashem HaMelucho, the bringing to the world this recognition of L'man Das Kol Amei Oretz, to know Hashem. And Esau is there again, Amalek is there again to try to stop us. I missed one, that even when from Mitzrayim the attempt was made to bury Yaakov in the Maros HaMachpelah, well, he actually was buried, but Esau, we know, was interfered or attempted to interfere with Yaakov's returning to his permanent place in the Maros HaMachpelah. Again, a step in the returning to of Klal Yisrael to Eretz Yisrael and the attempted interference. As we're trying to go into Eretz Yisrael, once again, Amalek. We know that after the first exile, when the Klal Yisrael was granted permission to return to Eretz Yisrael to rebuild the Beis HaMikdosh, that once again, a descendant of Esav, a descendant of Amalek, Homon, rose up to prevent that, to destroy Klal Yisrael, and it seems from a historical perspective, to prevent us from re-entering Eretz Yisrael at that time. And once again, Amalek is there. There were other times in history as well, but probably the most dramatic in recent history, when after so many years of exile, there began attempts to return to Eretz Yisrael. And we know that there was a major effort to exterminate the Klal Yisrael. And according to a Kabbalah that we have from the Vilna Goyin, that these people were muhzak, to be descendants of Amalek. And once again, an effort to destroy Klal Yisrael, to prevent us from returning to Eretz Yisrael. Now, this particular scenario doesn't really do very much for anyone, but it gives a certain sense when we see a certain pattern in Jewish history, when we see a concept that was laid out to begin with, and once again and again and again and again, every time that Klal Yisrael, or even the forerunners of Klal Yisrael, Yaakov Avinu, was attempting to come to Eretz Yisrael, that there is this interference, this battle between good and evil, which just gives us a sense of the Torah being a blueprint for history. History unfolds according to some certain Torah patterns. And the more that our children get the sense, and this is presented just as an interesting thought of the Parsha, you know, we have this encounter, was the second of the encounters between Yaakov and Esav, the first being in the womb, and it follows the pattern through history. Doesn't prove anything to our children, but gives them a sense of, wow, there's something very special and unique about the information and the knowledge and the patterns of history that Torah teaches us, something which can serve as a form of chizuk. At the same time, we have to find ways of strengthening the appreciation for the benefits of mitzvahs. That being something that if our children have this sense of mitzvahs make me feel good, mitzvahs are good for me, Torah is a benefit in my life, it's going to make me happy, then of course this feeling makes a higher level of motivation to want to recognize, to want to realize, to want to accept the truth of Torah, and therefore combine that good and true to a commitment to a Torah lifestyle. And I thought maybe it would be appropriate for a few moments just to discuss one very burdensome mitzvah, which sometimes to children seems as an overwhelming burden, and yet to adults seems to be their basis for survival, and that is the Shabbos. You know, secular Jews, and sometimes non-Jews, wonder, how can you spend 25 hours a week totally cut off from everything. Modern technology, electricity, other than that which is put on before the Shabbos. Tenets are a phone, not even permissible to engage in some of the activities which we would think would be enjoyable and restful. Restrictions, so many restrictions, 39 categories of melocha which are forbidden, and so many details and drabonon and muktze, and it permeates our entire existence. And it begs the question of, like, how, why, what are we doing? What is this all about? Now, of course, an adult just appreciates the rest of Shabbos, and I don't mean the rest, but the rest that one feels on Shabbos, the ability to rest, and, like, all the questions just disappear. The sleep is deeper and more peaceful. The tranquility that I'm just not permitted to be involved in my work day, in my work week, in my work life, is a blessing that's unreal and overwhelmingly positive. But certainly to children, it seems much more restrictive, and even to some adults, and therefore requires some type of an explanation. And I think that one of the best and simplest explanations which can begin even at the youngest ages of our children's development, and I'm not talking about 3 or 4, but maybe 6 or 7, is the concept of what is menucha. Shabbos is a day, vayonach b'yom hashvi'i, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted menucha. Menucha is roughly translated as rest. But what does it mean, and why is it so important? And here the Sipurnu has a very terse comment. Well, it's part of a whole arichus, but he says, uvishleimus tihiyah menucha. In completion lies the definition of menucha. Rest really means, menucha really means completion. My world is completed. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, vayonach bayim hashvi'i, it means that he rested on the 7th day because 6 days he was involved in the creation of a world. On the 7th day he rested. Not a rest in the sense of 6 days of hard work, wearing his overalls and shoveling and dirtying his hands and getting it all done, and on the 7th day just flops into bed and doesn't have the strength to move anymore and relaxes and rejuvenates himself. No, it wasn't physical work. We're not talking about the work. We're talking about the shleimus tihiyah menucha. Shabbos represented the completedness of creation. The world was created, completely finished. Bo Shabbos bo menucha, the only creation that was left to create was menucha itself. And on Shabbos was that state of total completedness. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the creator, was in a state of total completedness. His world was complete. And he gave us a special sign of a bond, a unique bond between the Klal Yisrael and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That bond, that ois, that sign of our unique relationship is the Shabbos, the day that celebrates the anniversary of my completion of the world. And it was given to Klal Yisrael to celebrate together with me as a sign of that special connection and relationship that we have. It's something that privileges us. It's something that validates us. It's something that uplifts us because it represents a very, very privileged status. In fact, we say in the davening, "V'lo nesato Hashem Elokeinu l'goyim arotzis." He didn't give the Shabbos to the other goyim. No, didn't give any of the mitzvahs to the other goyim except for sheva mitzvahs b'nei noach. But Shabbos he didn't give to the goyim is a special concept, because really, by right he should have. Creation is to the entire world, and the entire world should be celebrating it. No. Because this is a special gift to Klal Yisrael as a sign of our unique relationship with the Borei Olam. This concept can be so validating. This concept can be so uplifting. This concept could be so powerful to enhance our self-esteem, because we recognize the unique status that we have together with, in relationship to, the Creator Himself. But it goes much further. The status of shleimus, that feeling of completedness, permeates our whole existence. There's 39 categories of forbidden activity that we can't do. Activities that would be involved in completing. And on Shabbos, our world is complete. Anything that I need to be completed has to be completed before Shabbos. So in Shabbos, I live in a state of total completedness. If I need something cooked or baked or sown or planted or harvested or slaughtered or in any of these other changes of the natural state, it all has to be done before Shabbos. Whatever I need. When Shabbos comes, my world is complete. There's nothing left to be done, and I'm forbidden to do anything to complete that world. It must be complete before. Even without the use of an Eruv, even if I need a Siddur in the shul, and my house is across the street, it has to be there. It can't be carried there. It has to be there before Shabbos. Then my world is complete. When Shabbos comes, when that sun sets, when those candles are lit, Bo Shabbos Bo Menucha, a state, a veil of total tranquility envelops me. There's nothing left to be done because everything had to be done, and nothing is permissible to be done, to be completed, that wasn't completed before. And perforce, I have to be in a state of rest and completedness. And it's a physically, emotionally, psychologically, such a tranquil state. The knowledge that it's absolutely forbidden to deal with any of the issues or the problems that have to do with my mundane and my worldly and my weekly and my professional existence, it's exhilarating, it's liberating. It gives me that sense of everything's taken care of. My world is complete. I can't do anything about it anyway. And of course, this leads to a great state of tranquility in the sense that if my world is complete and there's nothing I can do about it, so I realize, well, what about the problems? I have to rely on HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He told me not to do anything. I guess he'll take care of it. We have a special relationship. The tranquility and the rest of this day is a sign, having given it to us as opposed to the other nations of the world, is a sign of our unique status, of our unique relationship. And I rely on that relationship to take care of me, to be able to sustain me, to be able to deal with my problems. Since I can't do anything about them, I stop worrying about them because there's nothing I can do anyway. And I begin to feel as if they were all taken care of and resolved. I'll never forget the time when we were purchasing a facility for our yeshiva and walked into my family, to my house Friday night after shul and announced, oh, I'm short $200,000 this week to close on the building. But I announced, don't worry. Shabbos, the money is in the bank. Sheshes yomim tavod v'asisa kol malachtecho. Rashi says, ki'ilu kol malachtecho asuya. Shia beinecho, it should be in your eyes as if everything's done. And the money's in the bank, no problem. I was a little bit worried because when you make havdolah, the money usually goes out. So I thought maybe we'll do the closing on Monday and make havdolah after the closing. But it didn't have to come to that. And Baruch Hashem, we managed. But that's the idea. My world is done. My world is complete. The money's in the bank. Problems are gone. When one day out of seven, in completedness, in tranquility, in the absence of all my difficulties, because of the fact that I can't do anything about it, and because of the special relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, with the Creator, who's given me this day to celebrate, so I feel that sense of trust in Him because we have that special relationship. And He proscribed me from doing anything about it, He'll take care of me. How much bitochon, how much trust in Hashem did those Jews in the early part of the last century, who some of them, they say, used to hold 80 jobs in 2 years, because every time they wouldn't show up for Shabbos, they'd be fired. But they wouldn't come in for Shabbos, because they trusted that HaKadosh Baruch Hu would provide for them. The Shabbos, the completedness of Shabbos, the fact that I don't have to worry about any of my problems, gave that sense not only of psychological and emotional and physical tranquility, sense of spiritual reliance and trust in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that He's going to take care of everything. It's much like the story about the rabbi who used to go to the president of his shul every Friday afternoon and say, please lend me $10,000. I'm going to return it to you right after Shabbos. And this went on for months, and the president had no real problems with it, like he was getting his money back every week, but it bothered him, like, what's going on? So he says to him once, rabbi, what does a rabbi do with $10,000 over a Shabbos? especially give it back right after. So the rabbi says to him and smiles and says, you know, you have no idea how much better the sermon comes out when there's $10,000 sitting in the bank. It's a different world when I have the money in the bank. Vacations that we force ourselves into, that we can, we want to be finished with everything, we don't have anything to do with it. How many people are constantly in touch over the phone, the cell phone, the email? It's like, I can't, I have problems, business. Shabbos, the world could close down. It makes no difference because there's nothing I am permitted under any circumstances to do about it anyway. And therefore, I learn not to worry. It can almost be described, I think, best by a poet, a German poet, who described the caught the essence of the Shabbos emotion in a poem that he wrote. And he writes about a Polish landowner who was a nice guy and used to visit his tenants from time to time to see how they were doing. One Friday night, he happens upon this Jewish family, sees her sitting around the Shabbos table, singing Zmirois, talking to each other, animated, beautiful, happy, tranquil, an environment that he had never seen before. And he sees it dripping in from the ceiling, and he sees the chairs are wobbly, and the table, cold cloth is patched, and the clothing tattered, and the food sparse, and he sees this contrast between object poverty and such happiness and tranquility and fulfillment. And he was so touched by this contrast that he walks up to the Balabayas and he says, Rabbi Yid, one wish, anything you want, he asks. He says, anything you want, it'll be granted to you. Here this poor Jew had the opportunity to get $1 million, to get a new job, to get a new house, anything, any wish, he would have been granted. And he says to the landowner, he says, could you be so kind? The candle that's burning on the table is bent, and it's dripping out fast, and it's going to go out before the meal is finished, before earlier, so we won't be able to enjoy the Shabbos together. Could you be so kind as to straighten it up so we can enjoy more of the Shabbos together with the family? And it's a very profound, I don't know what the author meant, but a very profound lesson that this poor Jew, who in his real life, in his workday life, in his 6 days of the week, was lacking so much, when it came to the question on Shabbos of what are you lacking, he couldn't relate to the question. He could, what am I lacking? Nothing. Money? Parnosa? A house? A job? I don't know what you're talking about. The only thing that I'm lacking is a Shabbos goy. I need someone to straighten up the candle. He couldn't imagine, he couldn't relate to the question of anything lacking in this total state of completedness, which the Shabbos represented. Truth of the matter is, we know that even the Shabbos goy, he's not supposed to use like that, but that's besides the point, I guess, in the eyes of Chazal, that even that state of completedness we should have, that I'm so lacking nothing, I'm not lacking anything. Even the Shabbos goy I could do without. But that's what all he could relate to was the question of, I need someone to straighten out the candle, a Shabbos goy. Other than that, I'm not lacking anything in my world. I don't even know what you're talking about. I can't even relate to your question. Now, of course, for younger children, this whole philosophical discussion is not going to do it for them. Of course, they should understand what it means to have a world that's complete, that everything that needs to be done should be done before, so I don't have to worry about anything. I don't have to worry. There's nothing to worry about because there's nothing I can do about it. And that message, to see it in us, to see the tranquility. If they see us waiting, can't wait to Havdalah because I got so much to do on Matzoy Shabbos, that may not get the message across. If they see us looking forward to Shabbos, if they see us elongating the Shabbos, I don't want to make Havdalah, I want to keep it going. If they see that sense of tranquility of Shabbos, if they sense in the way we walk, in the way we talk, in the way we interact with the family, the extra time that we seem to have, the more peace of mind that we seem to have, this can have an influence on our children. But even at the youngest stages, Shabbos has to be a day of enjoyment. If they can't appreciate what's going on at the Shabbos table, then there's really no point in them having to sit there for long hours. The Shabbos table should focus on each and every different level of children. Guests are very important, but the guests can't take away the emphasis from our children. And our children can't be relegated to only the older children and those who can speak and those who have ideas, but the younger children have to be involved as well. A question that deals with them. And I would say not only asking them the parsha questions, but challenging them to think. Getting them involved in the argument, in the conversation, in the discussion, in a way on their level that they can be and that they could be involved. And in Torah, there's a level of involvement for everybody. I once heard from a big Talmud Chochem Yerushalayim, someone asked him, how could you prove that the Torah is from HaKadosh Baruch Hu in one sentence? One sentence. He said to him very simply, he says, where do you find a book, a document, that can be studied by a three-year-old and studied by a 95-year-old scholar who studied it thousands of times, and each one finds meaning and inspiration and relevance and significance? Torah is universal, and we have to make the Shabbos table experience a universal experience, including everyone who's there, young to old, each one on his level. If they can't all be involved in the same conversation, then separate conversations and discussions for them. If we do have to have guests because of the nature of what we do, then maybe there should be one meal on the Shabbos where it's only the family. But the family has to feel that they're part of that uplifting experience. Children should have new games and new toys special for Shabbos. Maybe getting them, you know, getting something new each time, or keeping it fresh, keeping it new, keeping it exciting, keeping it something to look forward to, so the day becomes associated with pleasure, the day becomes associated with feeling good, the day becomes associated with beautiful memories. This is really part of what can be done. A parent once told me that they had a child who was very shaky in their Yiddishkeit, and Shabbos was not a big thing to them. They didn't want to participate in the Shabbos table. They really didn't want to have much to do with the family. And this mother, for a long period of time, every Friday morning would ask her child, what's your favorite food? What would you like me to make special for you for Shabbos? And over a period of months was able to nurture that child back to the Shabbos and back to the family, because it was focused, the Shabbos was focused on the child. If we focus on our children, if we spend time with our children, it's very important to have learning, and for balabatim that don't have much time to learn, then Shabbos is more of a time to learn, but they also must find that time to be and to participate and to learn and to work with the family, because ultimately that experience of Shabbos has to be something that's very, very positive in our children's lives and in their experiences. Otherwise, it's not going to have that. If the burden of Shabbos is allowed to override the benefits and the tranquility and the peace of mind, then we've lost an anchor in the Yahadus that can really keep our children going. But if we work to make this Shabbos experience something unique and special, then it will have long-ranging effects. So once again here, a balance. You know, there's an opportunity to talk about something that's unique about Torah, strengthen the idea of this, wow, this Torah is a very special document. Where do you find such a thing that it traces events throughout history, all traced through the Torah in the same pattern, keeps on repeating itself as indicated by our Torah? Something very special. And the good feeling that the observance of Torah gives, that's a winning combination that can do wonders for ourselves and certainly wonders for our children.
Thank you for listening to this presentation brought to you by Priority One. Please visit us online at www.priority-one.org. That's priority-1.org, where you can download free audio and publications on parenting, teaching, and teens at risk. For more information or to make a donation, please visit us online or call 800-33-4EVER.